Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome to the 150th episode of the Strettycast. I'm joined by Sean Connolly, my co-host. Sean, how's things since we last caught up in the podcast?
All good, my friend, and congratulations on 150 episodes of this glorious podcast.
Thank you. Well, that's starting things on a positive note, but we have to jump into the first game of the season, a 2-1 defeat against Brighton. Unfortunately, well, I guess some people might say fortunately for my sake, I missed the game at the weekend. I had a dose of gastroparesis and I was feeling very under the weather. So Sean, I'm going to ask you some questions. Obviously, in the aftermath, I caught up on some of the analysis, what people have been saying. I have caught some highlights. And one thing that I wanted to push you on was the performance of some of the new signings. So we've seen a start from Lisandro Martinez and Christian Eriksen. And what I've seen from the highlights, it wasn't too bad. He certainly couldn't pin the defeat on them. I know Martinez was lucky not to give away a penalty, but there's definitely signs there of a good addition.
Oh, for sure there is. For sure there is. I suppose just specifically focusing on Christian Eriksen and Lisandro Martinez, they were very, very good. Like, you're talking about two sort of different debuts. You've got Christian Eriksen, who is well used to the Premier League. And I'm trying to get into a routine with Christian Eriksen that when I speak about him, I just speak about Christian Eriksen. I don't speak about the Christian Eriksen that suffered that awful situation that he did while international football. We're talking about a decorated Premier League footballer who has massive accolades behind him in terms of individual metrics with assists and with his set-piece delivery. And he just looked at home. He looked at home wearing the shirt. He looked at home inside the stadium and amongst a group of players that didn't really warrant much merit. He stood out leaps and bounds because he just had class about him. And one thing that I would say about Eriksen, as the game progressed and he sort of transitioned towards a more deeper line playmaker, he absolutely leaps and bounds is our best option and our best outlet towards that deep lying role. He's just class. But you know this anyway, because I spoke to you about Christian Eriksen many, many months ago, and I wrote an article for Australian News about Christian Eriksen and how he was going to be a valuable asset should we get it over the line. And I'm delighted we did. When you look at Lisandro Martinez, very, very good player, but a different type of debut, a guy who has never experienced full throttle Premier League football before. And he was good. He was very good, especially for the first 30 minutes, 35 minutes. He looked very, very assured.
Sean, I just want to throw in there in regards to that article. I think as your editor that I kind of pushed in the direction of a piece on Eriksen because Juan Mata was leaving, no?
Well, if that's what you want to say, then by all means, we can go with that. I think it was something we shared, wasn't it?
It was definitely something we shared. We definitely told United to go in that direction, right?
I think it was definitely all down to us. But what I was saying with Martin is very, very good for 30 minutes, 35 minutes. Yeah, it was very fortuitous not to give away a penalty. There was unnecessary critique about him, I feel, after the game, that people were saying he was maybe somewhat at fault for being out of position on certain occasions. And I would offer an alternative sort of stand on that, in that the overall structure of several first-team players that have been there since last season ultimately laid its light. For every action, there's a reaction. And take one of the goals that we conceded. For the life of me, now, it was the second goal, or it could have been the first goal, I can't remember, but the ball was lost just outside Brighton's box by McTominay because he dwindled on possession and he didn't know what to do with it and he gave the ball away. Brighton hit us on a counter, and in doing so, McTominay is naturally out of position because he's standing basically on their box. Fred is out of position because he's trying to just get some sort of formulation of structure in the centre of the field by himself while being overrun. But then you talk about as they approach our box, Dalot is dragged out of position. Maguire gets pulled out of position by Danny Welbeck, who did it over and over and over throughout the game. He made this run across him and inadvertently just continuously got away with it. And as Maguire was dragged out of position by Welbeck running past him, Martinez then had to come into the space to be able to make up the position that Maguire had left out, which inadvertently left Shaw coming into the position to try to make up the pace that Martinez had left out. And then that left acres of space on the other side of the box, which inadvertently led to goals.
So when you say that, what are you pointing out as the biggest issues from Sunday's opening game to the season for United?
Well, for me, I think there's several different ways to look at it. Obviously, goals win games. We really, really struggled to get our final third into the game. That was one of the biggest things, because first and foremost, the largest issue, our midfield was non-existent. Okay, Fred and McTominay were a very poor duo on that particular day. Now, as someone who has been an advocate for hoping that the progression of Scott McTominay would come on and on and on, and I've often varied between this guy is a valuable asset as a squad player, as a rotational player, as a role player, as somebody who can come in and do a job. He's regressed tremendously over the last few months of last season. And in this particular game against Brighton, for a guy who's in that position, is supposed to be carrying the ball forward, working as a midfield linchpin, he seemed clueless. He seemed unable to distribute the ball in sort of a correct fashion. But at the same time, I move away from sort of classifying Fred in the same vein as I would McTominay, because I think we've seen ample examples over several games from last season. Fred is pushed more advanced. Fred is a very, very good footballer, and he can do a very, very good job in the squad as a more advanced midfielder. But the main issue is, for me, McTominay was very, very poor, and Maguire got a lot of plaudits for having a good game. Initially, when I looked at it, I thought, you know, he wasn't so bad. As I looked back on it further, his positional sense was rather poor in the game. And Danny Welbeck, a 31-year-old Danny Welbeck, who was deemed not good enough to make the grade at Manchester United, ran him inside out over and over and over again, putting him out of position, which inadvertently ruined the defensive structure because Martinez had to come over and try to fill that void.
I think, from listening to this, that Ten Hag has big decisions to make ahead of the away game against Brentford, because... Mm-hmm. If you're talking about Danny Welbeck doing damage like this, a player I think at this moment in time Manchester United should be looking at that we're coming up against this weekend that will cause us problems is Ivan Toney. He will certainly cause problems. And if Ten Hag doesn't address not only the problem in midfield between Fred and McTominay, that's going to open up Maguire and Lisandro Martinez against multiple teams. We're not talking about the best teams in the league here. We're talking about Brighton. We're talking about Brentford. And then the game after that's against Liverpool, right? So United, we've spoken about this on the podcast this summer, and we'll get onto it because we've quite a few questions to get through in regards to transfers.
Sure.
But the delay and how long it's taken to land the manager's targets is absolutely shambolic. And I see a report today from The Sun. Now, I don't know if it's reliable or not, but it states that Ten Hag wants to have an active role in searching for a backup goalkeeper. He doesn't trust Tom Heaton, and I either would I. But on that, I think Ten Hag is probably waking up to the fact that he needs to have an active approach on all transfers. You know, we said it this summer in the last episode about Frankie de Jong. Surely Ten Hag has picked up the phone and got assurances from the player that he wants to come to Manchester United. Because otherwise, I don't believe United would stay in talks for 10 weeks for a player that doesn't want to be there. You know, that's been branded around. And just before we go on to more about the game, Sean, something I wanted to stress before we get into transfers too is the Chelsea stuff. The reports about Todd Boehly apparently ringing Frankie de Jong is absolute bullshit. Frankie de Jong will not speak to United, Chelsea or any club until Barcelona pay up the money. And that's the current stance on it. And regardless of what people are saying elsewhere, I find it very hard to believe that anyone knows de Jong's actual preference if he is to leave Barcelona this summer. But just back to the game, Sean, and another question that I had as someone that missed out. Ten Hag made the big decision to play Christian Eriksen as a false nine from the start. And ultimately, that meant leaving Cristiano Ronaldo on the bench. Did that backfire? He brought Ronaldo on in the second half?
No, I don't think it backfired. I mean, he made the correct decision. Players should be picked on merit, and players should be picked on, especially in the first game of the season, players should be picked on their application and training and how they have progressed through preseason. I think it was the correct decision for him to leave Ronaldo on the bench, even disregarding the politics and everything that's happened off the field. You're talking about a guy who had little to no integration with the first team through that preseason tour, and what he did had, it was minuscule. It was the time he spent, there was nothing of note he really did on the pitch. So I think the decision was correct, and ultimately the false nine wasn't as a result of Ronaldo being left on the bench. It was a result of a lack of options because we don't have the players there. It's an unfortunate. I think it's very unfortunate after the preseason that Martial got the injury that he did, because I know preseason is preseason. We can just go back to preseason under Louis van Gaal and see us play like peak Manchester United, tearing teams apart. And then we come out the first game of the season, and it's almost a mirror image of what happened under Erik ten Hag's first game against Brighton. Players forgot how to complete simple passes. Structure was out the window. This high press that we saw in preseason was just non-existent.
Sean, is this not a warning, a big alarm, that Manchester United cannot rely on Anthony Martial?
But his injury record and his track record with, I suppose, availability. What do we say time and time again, that the biggest attribute that a player can have is availability, and Martial is injured quite a bit.
The biggest query that I have over this is, okay, he went to Seville second half of last season, didn't exactly light up the place, came back pre-season and got a great chance under the new manager to really fulfill his career at Manchester United again, and not a chance I don't think anyone expected him to get. But he had a pre-season. There's obviously upped intensity in training. It shows he's already had to get an hamstring injury. Can't be relied on. We're looking at this guy. If Ronaldo leaves currently to lead our line this summer, there was talks of Sesko coming. I know he's after agreeing to join Leipzig next summer. But the talk at the time was that he was going to come in as backup and that Martial was going to lead the line. I don't know where all of a sudden we're just relying on him. I know during the preseason we were excited about him. He scored 3 goals and he was joint scorer with Jadon Sancho. And he pressed really well, and he looked hungry and he was smiling. But I just not sold on this. I'm not sold on a lot of the things that were being told by the club at the moment. You know, the people that work at the club have been telling a number of journalists, including myself, that everything is rosy. Training's great. This is really, really impressive, high standard stuff. And then the start of the season, like you said, reminiscent to Van Gaal, where the start in the preseason, things look really, really good. And then we start the season, shit's the fan.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like a can of worms talking about this. I mean, the easy solution is obviously purchase a forward player who can play as a number nine when we need him to play as a number nine. But then if you sort of unravel it, you're looking about a guy who was given an opportunity in preseason and Martial, not just in his application in the games, but in his training and to work under the new manager to see if he's something that can, if he can fulfill what the manager wants. And he very much did. And as I said, when you asked me about the false nine and Ronaldo, he was going to be starting out number nine against Brighton on merit. Now, you have the other side of it with Ronaldo. If Ronaldo is going to stay at the club, and it looks like he very much is because nobody else wants him, like Ronaldo is still a goal scorer. So Ronaldo is still going to play many, many, many games this season for Manchester United. So you've got a guy there in Ronaldo who's going to play these many games, maybe not as many as he wants to, and he'll throw a strop every time he's put on the bench. But if Martial is fit and able, then Martial gives another option up front. I think what happened prior to Brighton was, I think it was a very unfortunate situation. I mean, obviously, the transfer strategy and the structure and the lack of bodies that we're bringing in as a striker is a huge issue, and it is the fundamental issue. But I think in this particular case, we're somewhat unfortunate. But when you look at it, Martial went to Spain on loan. He featured 12 times for Sevilla. You know, 12 times is what he was available for Sevilla. Now he fell out of favor with the manager. I think he had a knock when he was over there. Players get injured, and Martial is one of those players that gets injured a little bit more than other players do. But I still stand by what I said, because I said it even when he was on loan at Sevilla on this podcast. If he is back with us and he's any way interested, which it looks like he is, then he provides an entirely different dynamic. And he's a good player to have there. And we're very unfortunate he wasn't there against Brighton. But then again, if he's available against Brighton, does Christian Eriksen start?
There you go. Or does Fred and McTominay start?
Yeah, because I was thinking prior to Martial being injured, we're looking at a Brighton side that have now lost Yves Bissouma. So like they're down one of their main men in midfield.
Could be more fluid in midfield, yeah.
Could be more fluid in midfield instead of having two holding players. Maybe we just have one. And I had envisaged this situation where you had maybe Fred or even McTominay, but I think it was going to be Fred based on what I was seeing in the preseason games, playing as a sole six with Bruno and Eriksen in front of him. And then you have Martial as at nine, who's playing with his back to goal and allowing Sancho and Rashford to play in. And the structure was there. That's what I thought was going to happen. And it's very unfortunate what occurred afterwards.
Sean, just before we move on from the game, looking forward to Brentford, can United get back on track? And what you've seen on Sunday, like I've seen a lot of the reactions on social media. And as you can imagine, losing the first game of the season, people are really throwing the ties out of the pram. Now, I can kind of understand that given what we've seen in the transfer market this summer, and we've a new manager. You would expect that manager, someone that's so highly rated in the European game, to be heavily backed and to be given every opportunity to make this a successful journey. They haven't seen that. So when people are frustrated, like I get it. But the performance itself, how do you feel about that going into Brentford? Because they were a good side last season, but they won't have Eriksen.
Well, the performance the last day saw nine of the players that played against Brighton last year when we were beaten 4-0. Erik ten Hag is a fantastic manager and he's a great tactician, but he's not a magician. He doesn't have a magic wand. And he can't just come in and immediately make these players better after pre-season. I was tweeting prior to the game starting that if you can't be optimistic in pre-season, what's the point in even being a football fan? Because it's the only time of the season when everybody starts out on zero. It's a complete unknown variable.
Well, there's no point watching it if you're not going to be positive about it.
Yeah, exactly. And coming into Brentford now, you've got a side that are going to put it up to us again. You know exactly the way they're going to play. I mean, Ivan Toney, as you made reference to, is a very, very good forward. I mean, they themselves had a very, very sort of lively game against Leicester and hitting that late equaliser to go 2-2. And the player who hit the equaliser for them, his name escapes me right now, but he had only returned after an 18-month layoff when he actually thought he was going to have to retire with an injury. So their spirits are high. They're not going to be a walkover. They should be. Not necessarily a walkover, because no team in the Premier League is going to be a walkover, but Manchester United should be beating Brighton. Manchester United should be beating Brentford. But without having adequate players in the correct positions, we're going to have the same issues over and over again.
We want to get to some of the questions, which, like I said earlier on the podcast, dives into some of the latest stories we've been hearing around the transfer window. Now, the transfer window, before we get started, has been, I used the word shambolic already. It's been dragged out. Every transfer that Manchester United have completed so far has felt dragged out. The Frankie de Jong saga has gone on over 10 weeks now, and we still don't know the player's preference, whether he's interested in coming to Manchester United or not. So yeah, there's a lot to get through in these questions, so we're going to answer quite a few before we wrap it up. So Sean, first one that I have in, this one's in from Marlo. Why does the panel believe De Gea has escaped criticism about his shortcomings throughout the years from the mainstream media, whilst other players get a harder time for far, far less?
So the question is why is De Gea escaping this sort of criticism that the likes of Maguire is receiving?
From mainstream media.
I remember when De Gea signed and he had a particularly difficult first season, and something has always stuck with me was on Sky Sports and Jamie Redknapp's analysis of De Gea in his opening year. And he was very scathing of De Gea in that he was a player who was clearly not good enough for Manchester United. Because I remember in his opening year, he had difficulty with command of his area, with claiming long balls and with the physicality of the Premier League. Now, you move forward all these years, the same issues are still there. The only difference that's happened is De Gea has got older. You know, he's grown a bit of facial hair and he's changed his haircut. He's grown into his jersey a little bit. De Gea will always pull off these fantastic saves. De Gea is renowned for that. As to why he escapes criticism in the mainstream media, I can only guess. It is probably individuals that are just used to dealing with the Premier League as a whole and not fixating on one club. They look at Manchester United, they look at players, they look at individual accolades, and they see that this is a goalkeeper who won the Player of the Year X amount of times. That's the only reason I can see it, because what I see week in, week out is a guy making mistakes on so many different aspects. So I can't understand how he escapes the sort of scathing criticism that the likes of Fred would get or Maguire would get, to be perfectly honest with you.
I can totally get, right, I'm not sitting on the fence here. I can totally get what you're saying about mistakes. And I think it's definitely zoomed in and definitely focused now that Ten Hag has a particular style and wants his goalkeeper to come off his line, wants his goalkeeper to have a high standard of distribution. And these are all very, very important elements to the game, which now sees the goalkeeper almost become the 11th outfield player. So I get that. But what I'm saying is, I think your criticism's a little bit harsh because, yes, we get the game has progressed to this state right now. But not so long ago, De Gea was our best player. A few years ago, De Gea was our best player. No, so there was a time where I believe he was the best goalkeeper in the world. And I think like this question focuses on mainstream media. And I do get what they're saying about the way some people have picked on Harry Maguire. While other players have made loads of mistakes last season and don't quite get the same thing. I understand that. But if you jump on maybe not mainstream media and you jump on social media, you see the stuff that Harry Maguire gets, it's probably quite equal to David De Gea. I see montages every week on social media of De Gea mistakes. Every game, someone's sitting there for half an hour clipping up clips to show De Gea is making these mistakes. And it's like a fixation they have. It's not helpful. I'm sure you do that to every goalkeeper. They make mistakes. Now, I do get what you're saying. The modern game, he's making big... I think there's going to be problems with Erik ten Hag.
What I'm going to say in response to that, and it's not... Because I don't have an agenda with David De Gea. I love the guy for the length of time he has stayed. I'll always admire him as to how he responded to a fax machine. I mean, because a lot of players could have just thrown everything out of the pram after that fax machine occurred. But he has always given 100%. He's always handled himself in a very, very good manner off the field. When we're talking about a few years ago when he was being awarded our Player of the Year, you have to look at the managers we had at that time and the type of football that they played. Jose Mourinho is not renowned from playing out for the defence. Okay, David Moyes is not renowned from playing out from the fence. Louis van Gaal was not renowned from playing out from the fence. Louis van Gaal was just about ball retention. And if we have to pass the ball 400 times in our own half to get one pass forward, we will do that. When it comes into the public eye as much is when you have a manager that is trying to play out from defence. And that started with Solskjaer, because Solskjaer tried to start playing out from the fence. And what you've got now is a situation where prior to the goalkeeper being integral to the starting of each attacking phase, De Gea was being measured on his saves and on claiming the ball from corners and from crosses. So he might make three or four saves in a game that outweigh the cocked up cross that he's had. Whereas when you're now adding the fundamentals of taking the ball and distribution, it is another string onto his bow that's being measured. And I think that is why there's huge issues that have really circulated across the fan base. As to why they're not being picked up by mainstream media yet, I don't know.
I think, like I said there a minute ago, I think there will be problems with Ten Hag at some point this season and De Gea if he doesn't improve certain aspects of his game. But it'll be interesting because at the moment, the only backup is Tom Heaton. And personally, I wouldn't trust him. Another question from that listener, Sean, is from pre-season, Which youngsters do you think should be loaned out and who should definitely stay?
Who should definitely stay? Well, I think at this stage of his career, Jimmy Garner should stay. I think Jimmy Garner should be given time.
Is he going to get the time he needs?
With the current options that we have in his position, he should. I mean,
if we sign two more midfielders.
But if we sign two more midfielders, then the likelihood is he probably won't. But then you're getting to a situation where at this stage of his career and developing the squad as we are with bringing in other players, will he ever get the opportunity? So a certain point has to come in a young player's career when you say now is the time when you have to say if you're actually able to fight for a position at the club. Like Garnacho has got, I suppose, the definition of youth on his side now because he's really a teenager. Jimmy Garner is coming into the time in his career when he wants to establish himself at a football club and get a run. And I think now is the time where Jimmy Garner should be given an opportunity. But ultimately, you and I don't see the ins and outs and the intricate details that happen in training. So maybe he's not impressing enough. From everything I've seen from his career for years and years and years, I've always been hopeful of him developing a career at the club. I would like Jimmy Garner to stay. I certainly don't think, based on a few games and a few impressive cameos from Zidane and from Charlie McNeil, that they should be first team members over Jimmy Garner. I mean, I know that Zidane has been named in the first team squad for this season. So, by all accounts, it looks like he's going to stay. And I certainly don't think he should be staying over Jimmy Garner, not at this moment in time. As for Hannibal, I mean, Hannibal is kind of like this enigma because some people don't realize just how good Hannibal actually is. Hannibal is so good. Like he's a gifted footballer. And he's another one that I feel that even though he's young and could probably develop with time away and alone, I think he should stay too.
I think one of the players that should definitely stay from what I've seen on loan is Ethan Laird. Because I don't trust Wan-Bissaka as a backup option to Dalot. And I think with what Ten Hag's asking for, I think it's ridiculous. With what Ten Hag's asking for in his fullbacks, it's ridiculous that we would throw out Laird on loan and keep just Wan-Bissaka as our backup to Dalot, because an injury to Dalot and we're in big, big trouble there.
We are. And I would agree entirely. I mean, Ethan Laird is a brilliant player and he's at that stage of his career, similar to Jimmy Garner. But the big problem with Ethan Laird is the same problem that we've always had with Ethan Laird, is it's his availability. And you're talking about an injury to Dalot. Well, if you're keeping Dalot and then you've got Ethan Laird as his backup, Ethan Laird is very, very susceptible to injury. But at the same time, if he's ever going to make it as a Manchester United footballer, that's something that we're going to have to bite and hope that he can actually get past it. Because if you can rule out his injury record, which obviously you can't, but just for the basis of this conversation, he has all of the attributes to be a modern attacking fullback for Manchester United.
Sean, I have another question precisely for you from Jerry Kelleher. Do you see Rabiot as a decent signing? People say he's better than McTominay, and I get that, but for me, he's not what we need. We don't need another ego.
I think there's an awful lot of questions. An awful lot of questions and an awful lot of people who don't have answers about Adrian Rabiot. I think there's an awful lot of people that know little to nothing about Rabiot outside of what Wikipedia will tell them. And yes, I mean, it's well documented that he's an outspoken Frenchman. I mean, he's probably had enough controversies to fill an entire career at this stage. It's not necessarily just controversy at club level. There's also controversy for international. He's been classed as single-minded. He is, I suppose, backed by a somewhat uncompromising mother. He's determined. He's a bad egg. He's this. He's that. What we must remember is he's a guy who is in his peak years. He's played over 150 times for Paris Saint-Germain, nearly 100 times for Juventus, had agreed personal terms with Barcelona only to turn his nose up at them. This is a guy who is an extremely talented footballer. Like, he's very, very talented. He's talented enough that when Thomas Tuchel was his manager, he systematically selected him for about 3 to 4 months and made him captain. Now, at the same time, he then was able to turn around and say that basically, in a nutshell, like he has a bit of a controversial issue in terms of his mentality, but he obviously impressed Tuchel enough if he's going to make him captain. This is like Thomas Tuchel, who's revered through the English media. You're talking about Didier Deschamps, who selected him several times for France, dropped him several times for France, but then also come out and publicly stated that he'll never close the book on him. There's definitely a player there that I can tell you categorically, because I watch a lot of the Italian league. He's not a French Scott McTominay. This is a guy that, I suppose, when we look at that old adage of being a jack of all trades and a master of Les none. Scott? Pardon me?
Les Scott?
Les Scott. Rabiot is a very good player. There's one thing I'm going to say that a lot of people don't know this. Like, he has had to have a very, very hard upbringing, because he witnessed his father in the onset of having a stroke when he was a young teenager. And his father got such a bad stroke. It's one of those really, really rare ones where the only way he can actually communicate is by blinking his eyelids. And this is the guy that used to bring him to and from football training. Like, he was very close with his father. And I think it actually stems a long way as to why his mother has gone as uncompromising as she is, because she witnessed that as well. And she's just extremely protective of him. As I said, when he was first linked with the club, he has potential to be a hand grenade. He can come into that dressing room and he can cause ferocious issues. But Ten Hag is going to be aware of this. If you and I are aware of this, Ten Hag is aware of this. And Ten Hag has got autonomy over the transfer dealings of the club. So it's something that he's willing to do. And if we're going to say that we're going to back the manager, we have to back him with his players. And I honestly think Rabiot could be an extremely good signing for the club, but he could also be a disaster.
The question that I would have over this is, from the leaking that we are briefing that we've seen in the past maybe 4 years about background checks with players, and we just had a massive 2 year, maybe 3 year long saga with Paul Pogba and Mino Raiola totally pulling the strings and leaving the club on a free, and kind of Richard Arnold coming out meeting fans with a video leaked calling Pogba a twat. Okay, fair enough. I totally agree, Arnold. But then going out to sign someone like Rabiot, whose mum is quite a similar figure to Raiola. And in a sense, look, I'll pay some respect, because the top agents out there, Mino Raiola has passed, but was one of the top agents. They get the best deals for their clients. And that's why they're popular. And I'm sure Rabiot feels that his mum does a really good job and she gets some big deals. PSG, Juventus. But what I'm saying is, I don't want Manchester United falling down the hole of being another circus. We're a circus as it is, from top to bottom. And the dressing room, if we've any way of trying to kind of break away from the Glazer mold that they're a circus and the team isn't. Well, Ten Hag has to get the right players. And he said repeatedly over the summer that we won't just sign any player, we'll sign the right players. But I just don't think someone that's that outspoken right now and someone that has an agent that really throws their weight around the place, whatever circumstances they've been through, I just don't think that's helpful. And what about these background checks? Like, do they do them at all?
I assume they do, yeah. But again, I'm not going to just start like repeating everything that I said, but we're basing an awful lot on what has been. You got to remember, like, he's very much like a Wayne Rooney. He broke onto the professional scene very, very young, you know, and like he made his debut at, like, I believe it's 17, you know, for Paris Saint-Germain. I could be incorrect with that, but I think it was 17 or 18.
He was very young, I remember that, yeah.
And like, he's been around for a long, long time. And yeah, he might be a controversial figure. Yeah, he might have temperament and he mightn't respond very well to certain things, but there's a great footballer there. Footballers live on a different planet, though. I mean, if you look at it logically and you look at it right now, we need midfielders at the club. I'm not saying go out and just buy anyone, but we were linked to Rabiot like 3 months ago. You know, this people are referring to this as a panic buy on the basis of the defeat to Brighton. It's not that. The club have been well aware and the club have been considering a bid for him for several months. You know, and that's largely down to the recommendation of Erik ten Hag as well. He knows there's a player there. Look at the clubs he's played for. Look at the country that he's represented over 20 times. He might have been a controversial figure. He may still be a controversial figure. He might be a guy who at, I think he's 27, isn't he? That at 27 years of age now realizes that he has got one last opportunity to have a proper go of it and to make a point of it.
Do you believe, I don't believe that Ten Hag put Rabiot forward, but do you believe that Manchester United have been scouting him for the past 6 months?
I think it's a possibility because it's well known that when Ten Hag came to the club, just like the previous managers, I mean, it's every single manager that's come to the club has had documents and dossiers presented to him about scouting profiles of players that the club have scouted and players think would be good signings and that the club think these players would be good signings. They put them to the manager, just like they have with Ten Hag.
But what I will say in response to that is we've jumped to a very, very different scenario from wanting a Declan Rice to wanting a Frankie de Jong. And I think what that shows is that John Murto and co, they need a breathing period where with a new manager who they didn't know back then, they need a period where they need to soak up his ideas and then they're on the same page. That's what you'd hope would happen in the next year or so. It's not going to happen overnight. But what I think is that what they were looking at for this team is completely different. And it's quite clear that up until now that the only midfielder that Ten Hag is clearly that he wanted was Frankie de Jong. Frankie de Jong all along. And now we've been trying, there's a few names being linked around the place. There's Guido Rodriguez, who I've read reports today is complete. There's nothing to it. Apparently, there's reports about Serge Milinkovic-Savic, who I think is linked with Manchester United every year. It would be actually funny if he finally ended up at the club. But an interesting view that I just wanted to touch on before we wrap it up, Sean, is that if we did sign Rabiot and Milinkovic-Savic, now I'm not sold on either. I'm not sold on either, but a friend of mine said something to me today which kind of made me think a little bit. And he was suggesting that if our midfield three could transform from having Fred and McTominay to Rabiot and Milinkovic-Savic, that we could then have a midfield that could easily compete with the top five teams in the Premier League. And it made me think, because right now, as things stand with McTominay and Fred in those kind of anchor roles in midfield, I don't fancy our chances against any team. And I mentioned at the start of this podcast that we were talking about Brighton, we were talking about Brentford. We weren't necessarily talking about the Man Cities, the Chelseas, the Liverpools. We were talking about the lower, the kind of the bog standard teams in the top flight. And I know Brighton, are very, very good. I don't think I don't think Brentford will be as good this season. But what I'm saying is, I don't fancy this midfield currently against any team in the Premier League. But if we can make two additions like that, really don't really excite me. I think they can make a big difference.
Well, they can make an enormous difference. Like, football is won and lost in the centre of the park. Football has always been won and lost in the centre of the park. Games are won by goals being scored. But football matches are dictated by who can control the centre of the midfield. That's why Frankie de Jong is the number one target for the club. Because he can turn defence into attack like that. And he can control midfield because he's a very intelligent technical footballer. I still believe we're going to sign Frankie de Jong.
I was going to ask you, where is your stance on that right now?
It's never changed. It's at the beginning when we were linked with him, and the very first report that broke said he's not interested in coming. I said on this podcast, close the book, move on. We're not wasting our time with him. But as you and I discussed on a phone conversation the other day, when the club wanted Jurrien Timber, and Van Gaal convinced him that we were the devils, he turned around and said no, and then the club moved on and they went for Martinez. So that alone just leads me to think that if they had any whim that Frankie de Jong did not want to come, they'd have moved on to somebody else. So to solidify that, I think Frankie de Jong is still coming to the club. I do think we're going to get him. I don't think Chelsea need him. If Chelsea can complete the deals they're looking to complete, they're talking about spending $250 million. They're not going to go after Frankie de Jong and pay the excessive demands that Barcelona want. To move to what you said about Milinkovic-Savic and Rabiot, yes, absolutely. If you put the two of them into midfield, we control plenty. we don't have to control 90 minutes of a football game with Milinkovic Savage and Rabiot. We just have to be able to have players in the middle of the park that will not be run through. Those guys will not be run through. And not only will they not be run through, but that they can then pass to the more creative players like Bruno, Sancho, Rashford, Martial, Ronaldo, whoever is there. It's a case of just not allowing the other team to marshal their way through. Like you talk about Milinkovic Savage. As I said, I watch an awful lot of this area, an awful lot. And I don't understand why anybody would think Milinkovic Savage wouldn't be a good sign.
Is he the Serbian McTominay?
Well, I think everybody is going to be, like, we could be going for some poor lad from Senegal and he's going to be the Senegalese Scott McTominay, you know. Our fans are very, very difficult to please. We have a very, very difficult bunch to please. And, like, it's funny because you made reference to how you feel Ivan Toney would be a good sign, right? Now, I share that. I think Ivan Toney would be a good signing. I think he's a good player. If we sign Ivan Toney, within 1 week, the reports are going to be, look at the fall from grace. Manchester United, once pursuing of players like Ronaldo, now taking championship-promoted Ivan Toney. You know, that's all you
have. But you know what? The ironic thing about that, wouldn't you? Right. The ironic thing about that would be from journalists who all came out and said that United shouldn't have signed Ronaldo in the first place.
Exactly. Look, man, paper never refuses ink, and Manchester United will always generate interest. So it's inevitable.
I think we have to end it on that note for the Transfer Window podcast. That what you just said there just sums it up perfectly. Sean, thanks again for joining me on the Stratocast. How can people follow you on Twitter?
You can follow me on Twitter at SeanConnolly85, and I'll do my best to get back to every single one of you. I always do.
Brilliant. He loves the DMs. You can follow Stratocast at Stratocast, and make sure to subscribe to our newsletter at stretty.substack.com/welcome. You can also get 24/7 news around the Manchester United at strettynews.com. So thanks for listening. This is episode 150, and we'll be back again later this week with another episode. Thank you.
Sports Social Podcast Network.